The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2019 issue of Discover Magazine. This is a special issue, Apollo at 50. For our feature article today, we have To the Moon and Back. On July 20th, 1969, more than half a billion people watched as humans landed on the moon. Never before had our species trod upon another world, and we visited none since. But 50 years later, we are closer than ever to going back. Join us as we look back at what made the Apollo program a defining moment of our history and why it still resonates today. When we set sail. For Neil Armstrong, Apollo 11 was one small step in our migration into the cosmos. You'll find the name Neil Armstrong in any historical listing of the world's greatest explorers. No one would quarrel with the Apollo 11 commander, test pilot, and first man on the moon being high on that list. Except Armstrong, that is. He saw himself as an engineer first. In an early interview for my biography of Armstrong, he expressed the raison d'etre of his career in flight. I flew to the moon not so much to go there, but as part of developing the system that would allow it to happen. He once told the National Press Club, "I am, and ever will be, a White Sox, pocket protector, nerdy engineer, born under the second law of thermodynamics, steeped in the steam tables, in love with free body diagrams. Science is about what is. Engineering is about what can be." He did accept being called a pioneer because he knew the word connected etymologically to engineering. Popular culture long portrayed American pioneers as Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett, wearing buckskins, fighting off Shawnee warriors or red sticks, and opening the way to settlements on the western frontier. But the English word pioneer has a long history. The word ultimately derives from the medieval Latin word pedo, as in our English word pediatrician. In ancient times, pedones were foot soldiers whose job was to build and repair roads for the main body of troops. They were engineers, members of a construction corps who prepared the way for the main army. Armstrong's stock in trade was in league with his fellow pedones, paving the way. Once over lunch, I asked him to compare the moon landings to another event in human history. I thought, being an engineer, he would cite an invention, the wheel, the compass, the steam engine, the transistor. But as happens so often, his quick answer surprised me. The Austronesian expansion. He had just read Jared Diamond's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, which offers a bold and sweeping explanation of why Eurasian and North African civilizations survived and conquered others due to geographical and environmental advantages rather than intellectual, moral, or genetic superiorities. It was clear Armstrong admired the thesis, but he was focused on one chapter in particular, Speedboat to Polynesia. Archaeologists have found that groups of people were leaving Asia by boat tens of thousands of years ago. By 5000 BC, these immigrants had established a potent and versatile culture on the island of Taiwan, also once known as Formosa, combining fishing, gardening, and a little farming. But their migration was hardly over, Armstrong explained. Around 2500 BC, having mastered ocean navigation by plying the water between Taiwan and the coast of Asia, these enterprising, seagoing people, the Austronesians, spread out into the Philippine Islands. From there, they ventured even farther into the vast Pacific, which covers about one-third of Earth's entire surface. The Pacific Islands the Austronesians came to settle, eventually all the way to Hawaii and Easter Island, are like grains of sand scattered across the vast blue void. To think that a people could navigate the Pacific well enough to settle and establish culture on islands separated by so much ocean is truly extraordinary, Armstrong said. Yet somehow, early humans managed to reach them all. I asked Neil if he saw the Austronesian expansion as a forerunner for how humankind will become a true spacefaring civilization. Yes, I do, he said. We have learned how to navigate to the moon. That's like the ancient Chinese mainlanders learning how to get to Formosa. Formosa is the moon. After we settle it, we jump off from there to Mars, just like they went next to the Philippines, and from there all across our vast galaxy. If the Austronesians can sail in their boats and scatter into settlements all across Oceania, we can take our spacecraft and scatter and settle all across the Milky Way. It may take even longer than it took the Micronesians, but if they did it, so can we, he said, because they are us. Training the first lunar scientists. Putting a human on the moon was an epic feat of engineering. But another group of researchers made the Apollo mission successful, and they weren't at NASA. Geologists at the U.S. Geological Survey used lunar photographs and telescopes to make the first detailed maps of the lunar surface. They tested equipment and spacesuits in the rocky Arizona desert, even collecting rocks and measurements while fully suited. Without geologists, the Apollo missions might have been little more than rocket ship stunts. Much of the credit goes to Gene Shoemaker, who dreamed of going to the moon well before the space race popularized the idea in the early 1960s. He coined the term astrogeology while studying the moon from afar and preparing to someday visit the lunar surface. By the time that dream was actually possible, a medical problem disqualified him from astronaut service. Still, he went on to become one of the most influential scientists in the space program. Above, in a picture, Shoemaker demonstrates an early spacesuit prototype in 1964. He poses, of course, as if he were sampling rocks. Marketing the moon. How public relations transformed the lunar landings into a cultural moment. An astronaut, a little hop, and a witty quote. Neil Armstrong's first lunar step is ingrained in the minds of all humankind. But that first moon landing might not have been such a memorable moment if it weren't for NASA's savvy PR team. Richard Jurek is a marketing executive and co-author of the book Marketing the Moon, The Selling of the Apollo Lunar Program. He says NASA's move to real-time open communication made the 1969 Apollo 11 landing the first positive viral event that captured the world's attention. Before NASA was established in 1958, rockets were the military's purview. That secretiveness carried over into the space agency's early days. At first, NASA followed a fire-in-the-tail rule, only publicizing a rocket's launch when it was successfully in the air. But as the agency evolved, it started announcing more details about the Apollo program. It championed its astronauts, talked openly about mission goals and challenges, and shared launch times so people could watch. If it had been run like it was under the military, Jurek says, we would not have had that sense of drama, that sense of involvement, that sense of wonder, that reveal. Instead, all the PR and press hype in the years ahead of Apollo 11 brought the human spaceflight program into people's living rooms and imaginations. As the drama neared its climax, NASA's PR officials pushed for live TV broadcasts of the first humans to walk on the moon. Not everyone thought it was a good idea. The technology for live lunar broadcasts and cameras small enough to keep the payload manageable didn't exist at that point. Some engineers worried that developing that equipment would distract from the efforts to achieve the landing itself. But NASA's communications team argued that telling the story was as vital as the achievement itself. Live TV would bring the American people and international viewers along for the ride. Come landing day, which conveniently fell on a Sunday, more than half a billion people worldwide huddled around TVs and radios for the historic moment. We were able to come together and do something that was exciting and interesting and brought the world together, says David Meerman Scott, marketing strategist and co-author of Marketing the Moon. I don't know that we've done anything like that since. Women fight for flight. The Mercury 13 aced the same tests as male astronauts, but decades would pass before American women flew in space. Neil Armstrong took one small step for man in 1969, but it would be decades before NASA made one giant step for American women. The agency's first team of astronauts, dubbed the Mercury 7, were selected in 1959 after passing a strenuous series of fitness and medical exams. No women were asked to participate, but a year later, William Randolph Lovelace, the doctor who had designed the qualifying exams, invited seasoned pilot Jerry Cobb to complete the same qualifiers. The testing was intense, including having ice water blasted into her ears to induce vertigo and a rubber tube slid down her throat to test her stomach acid. She passed with flying colors, and within a year, 12 more female pilots not only had passed, but often exceeded the test scores of the Mercury 7. Decades later, this group would be nicknamed the Mercury 13. Further exams were scheduled at the Naval School of Aviation Medicine, but were abruptly canceled. Without an official NASA request, the school would not host Lovelace's privately funded testing. Cobb set off for Washington, D.C. to lobby for the project. In 1962, she testified before the House Committee on Science and Astronautics hearing on sex discrimination, saying, "There were women on the Mayflower and on the first wagon trains west, working alongside the men to forge new trails to new vistas. We ask that opportunity in the pioneering of space." But NASA's policy stood. Astronauts had to be graduates of military jet test pilot programs, effectively barring women. Though over 1,000 women had flown during World War II as part of the Women Air Force Service Pilots, they were considered civilians, and no branch of the military had subsequently allowed female pilots. Ultimately, the U.S. suffered a space race defeat when the Soviets launched cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova into orbit in 1963. Another 20 years would pass before NASA sent Sally Ride to space aboard the shuttle Challenger, finally realizing the dream of the Mercury 13. The science of Apollo. The mission data gathered remain the most valuable information we have about the history of the moon and the solar system. Before Apollo, humans could only learn so much about the moon. All they had were images of its near side and almost no information about its far side. After physically going there, here are a few of the questions we have now answered. What caused the lunar features? Scientists once debated whether the features we see on the moon's face were impact craters from meteors or signs of ancient volcanism. Then Apollo showed in stunning detail the difference between the moon's familiar near side and its highly cratered far side, along with close-up views of the craters in question, quashing the idea of conical volcanoes on the moon. But the dark lunar splotches did turn out to be lava-based basalts, proof the moon once had a more active molten interior. Where did the moon come from? Our current understanding is that an ancient Mars-sized world slammed into early Earth billions of years ago, and that the detritus from this encounter eventually coalesced into the moon. It was Apollo's recovered moon rocks that pointed scientists toward this dramatic and unlikely story. Analyses revealed how eerily similar Earth's and the moon's chemical distributions are, a sign that they share a common source. Studies also show that moon rocks were stripped of nearly all volatiles, materials that boil away easily, providing evidence of some long-ago disaster that eliminated them. What were the conditions like in the early solar system? All the rocky bodies we have studied bear scars from meteor impacts, some new and many very old. But Earth recycles its surface regularly, while the lunar surface keeps a pristine historical record. And the moon is one of the only places that we have been able to gather such ancient materials to measure their absolute ages, indicating, for instance, that one of its many craters formed about 3.9 billion years ago. The lunar rocks ultimately tell us of a violent chapter in solar system history, when a period known as the Late Heavy Bombardment rained down space rocks, heavily scarring the inner planets. What's inside the moon? While astronauts didn't do any deep mining, they did place seismometers at multiple sites to analyze moonquakes. These can come from the moon itself, from meteor impacts that still occur, and from astronaut-made explosions, set off to watch how the reverberations travel through the lunar material. The readings revealed a crust around 40 miles thick and a small core some 400 miles across. Apollo in their own words. The men who flew to the moon reflect on legacies, comfort, and loneliness. Being an astronaut isn't easy. Grueling physical training, punishing mental workouts, willpower pushed to the limits, plus, of course, the risks. There's no guarantee of safe return. If you want to get in this business, says Apollo astronaut Jim Lovell, you better be optimistic. The 32 men assigned to fly in the Apollo program faced unprecedented challenges, but they also got to do something no one else has ever done. We spoke to some of them to find out what that was like. Walter Cunningham, Apollo 7, October 1968. Interviewed in July 2018, now age 87. On dealing with the pressures. The general public at large was excited and kind of filled with a tenseness over the fact that the previous manned mission had been a fatal accident. But we never expected that, of course. I'm sure that the prior crew did not either. But we spent 21 months getting about 1,060 changes in the spacecraft. Our crew was responsible for some of them. The engineers were responsible for most of them. And we are all working together, looking forward to getting back on schedule and landing a man on the moon before the decade was out, because that was the goal. We were also still in a race with the Russians. It's interesting. We got into orbit, and we had a lot of objectives to accomplish because there were a lot of tests up there. But there was also kind of a sense of relief. We were away from all of the engineers and all of the ground controllers, and they wouldn't talk to us very often. We just started going to work on the things we could. On the importance of exploring. I think that the education of our society at large should be focusing more and more on asking real questions about pushing our whole society out farther and farther. We've spent a whole lot of time making things more efficient, which is pretty good, but we don't teach people that you've got to be willing to stick your neck out to get someplace in the universe or in the world. James McDivitt, Apollo 9, March 1969, Apollo Manager, 1969 through 1972. Interviewed in September 2018, now age 88. On making it happen. Apollo had the backing of the American people, so it was fully funded. And during the time that I ran the program, I didn't have any need for extra money. The money that was allocated was sufficient to do the program, unlike later programs where NASA asked for less than it took to run a program, and consequently they were always stretched for dough. The NASA administrator during the time of the Apollo stuff asked the engineers how much they thought it would cost, and they came back with a figure of around $20 billion. He went to Congress and said it was going to cost $40 billion. Congress approved it, and we had enough money to do it right. Now, later on, being on the outside, it looks like they go in and ask for what they think they can get and not what they think they need. On upgrades. The Gemini capsule was very, very tight. You couldn't stretch all of the way out. You were in the seat, and that's where you stayed. In Apollo, we'd get up and float around, so it was much more comfortable. Yeah, it was a much bigger spacecraft. Russell Rusty Schweikart, Apollo 9, March 1969. Interviewed in October 2018, now age 83. On lunch breaks. You begin doing some of the final testing on the vehicle itself stacked on the launch pad. Now you're no longer in the Rockwell factory or the Grumman factory, but you're now on the launch pad, on top of that big Saturn V, 360-some feet in the air, and the gantry all around. You take a break for lunch, and all of the guys in the control room have taken a break for lunch, and you've got a brown bag there with your sandwiches and your drink. Regularly, I, and everyone else, I'm sure, that was on a crew, would walk out along the steel structure of the gantry, up at that 360-foot level, and you would sit out, dangling your legs over the ocean, looking out over the ocean, the highest thing in Florida, in more ways than one, probably. But those kinds of moments are the things that are so personal and stay with you. They're just wonderful moments. On keeping his head. My way of dealing with susceptibility to motion sickness on Apollo 9 was to say, okay, I'm the lunar module pilot. I don't have to move around in the first couple of days on the mission. That's up to Jim McDivitt and Dave Scott. I'm going to sit here, and I'm not going to move my head a lot, and I'm going to adapt without getting sick. That was a great scheme, except that after I got sick, we learned that you don't adapt without moving your head. All I did was delay my adaptation to the worst possible time. It was absolutely perverse. but I thought I was doing the right thing, and nobody knew enough to tell me not to. The doctors didn't know diddly squat, and the motion sickness pills don't work worth a damn. Michael Collins, Apollo 11, July 1969, interviewed on October 2018, now age 88. On possible loneliness. When I got back, we were subjected to a lot of press inquiries. And when they came to me, most of them centered on, weren't you the loneliest man in the history of space, behind the lonely moon all by your lonely self? I thought their question was ridiculous. I simply said that I was too busy to be lonely. However, the truth was considerably different. I was very happy with the command module. In a way, I thought it was like a miniature cathedral. The altar was really our guidance and navigation station, and we didn't have any clerestory windows, but we had a nice lighting, and it was an elegant, sturdy, spacious place. It was my home. I was king. I was not a master of the universe. I was not even an apprentice in the universe, but I was king, and you know, like most kings, I had to be careful. Like, there goes the fuel cell number 3 acting up again. I didn't feel away and isolated. I felt like I was doing a useful job, and I felt included, not excluded. And so I was very happy to be there that way. And lonely? No. On the view from the launch pad. Getting into the spacecraft is sort of odd. It's not like you go out to that giant booster every day, but we'd been out there a number of times, and it was always a beehive of activity. The day of the launch was quiet. There was nobody around. And we got in this dinky little elevator and went up 360 feet, roughly, and got off at what they called the white room. And then slowly, one by one, other things happened. We loaded ourselves into the command module Columbia, but I had plenty of time to look around. I can remember if I closed my right eye, all I saw was the beach and the ocean, and the world of Ponce de Leon it could have been. There was no sign of humanity. It was just good old planet Earth. Vice versa, if I closed my left eye, then I saw this gigantic heap of complex machinery, the 20th century that we were, people of machines. And I can remember looking and saying, geez, I see that, I see that. I'm not sure if I'm in the right one. Jim Lovell, Apollo 8, December 1968, Apollo 13, April 1970. Interviewed in June 2018, now age 91. On leaving Earth during Apollo 8. We were so busy doing things. We went around the Earth, first of all, to test out our spacecraft. We were concentrating on how the Saturn rocket was working and everything like that. We knew that we were going to the moon, but it was only at the end of the Earth orbit when everything on the spacecraft was fine that I suddenly realized, hey, we're leaving the Earth. We're not just going to Earth orbit. And then looking back right after that, when the engine stopped and we were up to a little bit over 23,000 miles per hour, you could look back and see the Earth shrinking. It was sort of like if you're in an automobile and you're going through a tunnel. You look in the rearview mirror and you can see the tunnel opening slowly and closing and closing. That's exactly what it felt like. On faith. I don't think that any flight to the moon and back ever wondered whether the engines would light again or not. I mean, you have to take that on faith. There is no alternative. That's what's going to happen. Al Warden, Apollo 15, July through August, 1971. Interviewed in October 2018, now age 87. On being alone. I was raised in the Air Force as a single-seat fighter pilot, so I was used to being by myself. As a matter of fact, I preferred to be by myself because I didn't really want to be responsible for somebody else on the flight. I didn't feel lonely. There's a difference between being lonely and being alone. I was alone, but I wasn't lonely. The best part of the lunar flight for me in those 3 days at the moon was when I was on the backside of the moon, cut off from mission control. I didn't even have to talk to them. I was very comfortable. On lunar science. I was very busy in lunar orbit, probably did more science than they did back on the surface. The guys who go down to the surface, they have one thing in mind. Their goal was to pick up every different color rock they can find and bring it back. In the meantime, I'm photographing 25% of the moon's surface. So there was a lot involved in what I did, but it wasn't romantic like walking on the moon. I didn't have the facilities with me to take any pictures inside. Well, I'm not a selfie kind of guy anyway. Neil Armstrong's children. Their dad flew on Apollo 11, July 1969, Armstrong died in 2012. On having an extraordinary father, Rick Armstrong. He was just dad. He just went to work. We were just an ordinary family. We did ordinary things. We had ordinary problems. On humility, Rick Armstrong. He always liked to say that he wasn't picked to be first to be on the moon. It just worked out that way. Any one of the astronauts in the Apollo program could have ended up in the same spot. On success, Mark Armstrong. I think there's plenty of Neil Armstrongs out there in the world, because if you break it down a little bit, he's a guy who wanted to serve his country. He worked hard. He prepared himself as best as he could for whatever the future might bring him. He used to say that success is where preparation met opportunity. Back to the moon, and this time to stay. Invigorated by a renewed fascination with space exploration, as well as the emergence of billionaire-backed private spaceflight companies, humans are once again shooting for the moon. Cutting-edge crew capsules, powerful rockets, and the world's first moon-orbiting space station could launch a new push to explore and eventually inhabit the lunar surface. So buckle up, the next decade is sure to be a wild ride. Luna. The Soviets abandoned their moon dreams after the Luna 24 mission in 1976, but now Russia has planned at least 5 uncrewed missions. The first, Luna 25, could land near the moon's south pole in 2021 to prospect for minerals, water, and other resources that cosmonauts would need for a moon base. Crew Dragon. SpaceX's Dragon cargo capsule already delivers supplies to the International Space Station. But starting this summer, a crewed version of the capsule will start carrying humans as well. SpaceX is also finalizing modifications to let Dragon carry up to 7 astronauts, or tourists, even farther into lunar orbit. Orion capsule. Astronauts need a reliable vehicle to commute from Earth to the upcoming Lunar Gateway space station. That's where the Orion crew capsule comes in. Developed by Lockheed Martin, NASA, and the European Space Agency, the spacecraft could ferry up to 6 astronauts to lunar orbit by the early 2020s. Chang'e. China's Chang'e 4 mission made the first landing on the moon's far side in January. Future missions will collect and return lunar samples, explore the poles for resources that could be mined, and prep for a Chinese crew of taikonauts sometime in the 2030s. Deep Space Getaway. NASA says it will begin launching modules in 2022 for the Lunar Orbital Platform Gateway, a space station that will orbit the moon. Once built, it will house up to 4 astronauts and their experiments during 30 to 90-day lunar missions. Lunar XPRIZE. The decades-long Google Lunar XPRIZE, which offered $20 million to the first commercial company that lands a functioning robot on the moon, ended last year without a winner. But now, at least 5 teams have concrete plans to land on the lunar surface within a few years. And the XPRIZE Foundation is chasing new sponsors to revive the contest. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time, if you have any comment or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. Again, that's area code 919-832-5138.